Now, Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Well, as far as I know, it's still alive. A new baby orca, the southern resident killer whales, of which there were only 74 left in existence. I guess this number would go to 75 now. It's dubbed L124. That's because it's part of L-Pod, and it is the first L-Pod killer whale born and confirmed since the last one. That was L123 Lazuli, which used to be the youngest killer whale on Earth in the southern resident population, born in November of the year 2015. Here to talk more about this, give her thoughts on this, is Misty McDuffie, Wild Salmon Program Director, Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Misty, normally when you and I have these conversations, it's because another one of these animals has died and we sort of gaze bleakly into the abyss that is the future. But there's a new baby whale today. What do you think of that?
It's very exciting and it's really encouraging.
So let's take a look at L-Pod in general. L-Pod was also the same pod as the last killer whale was born in L123 Lazuli in 2015. Is there something special about this pod as opposed to J&K?
No, but this pod has seen more decline than J&K have. So some of the really dramatic decline that has occurred in the southern residents is driven by L-Pod.
My understanding is that this calf was first spotted on Thursday. It was TV stations in the Seattle area apparently had live aerial footage of several killer whales in Puget Sound. And what happened is people looked at the television pictures who knew and were able to recognize these whales and noticed there was a baby that shouldn't have been there, but was there. What do you think of that?
Yeah, it's it is really neat the way it unfolded. But I think they did identify L77, they knew that there were three pregnant females, and I think okay. L77 was one of them, along with K27 and J41, who as of last observations, were still pregnant. So they did know she was pregnant.
Let's talk about the gestation period for these whales, because once we see a pregnancy, or at least suspect a pregnancy, this isn't something that's over with quickly, not nearly as fast as a human being. How long is it?
Yeah, it's like 18 months. It's quite something.
So for a year and a half. So when one of these little babies is born, of course, whales being mammals, the calf has to be nursed. How does that all work? Like, I'm trying to imagine it. Like, they're underwater in my mind. I don't even know.
Yeah, and so then they should have enough blubber to be able to get them to the surface. But the other whales will help bring them to the surface, and they've got to start nursing right away.
Okay, yeah. Because they have to consume an enormous number of calories every day to grow as fast as they do.
They do, and again, that often goes back to us calculating how many. We often use it in Chinook units, how many they need a day and how big those fish have to be, and then the size of the whale that's eating them, and caloric intake. And it always comes back, especially right now, to are they going to get enough caloric intake from the Chinook that are present?
And you knew where I was going with that, because it is the lack of the presence of the Chinook salmon and the decrease in the average size of Chinook salmon that is negatively impacting this particular species. So when there is a new baby, you would think that mom needs lots of nutrition, baby needs lots of nutrition. In terms of this particular time of the year, is this a good time? Is this a bad time in terms of salmon availability?
Yeah, so it isn't great right now, because a lot of the runs that they are here to feed on in the, from the spring through to the fall have moved into the rivers. And what southern residents do in the fall is they usually switch to chum, and then when the chum have all gone into their rivers and they would be in inside waters, like say in the Salish Sea, they would be feeding on immature Chinook and coho that are rearing in the Salish Sea right now.
So how do they know to switch to chum? Is there it's fall, we're switching to chum now, or is that understood?
Well, I think it's simply driven by the disappearing presence of larger Chinook.
Okay, so they just basically, they're looking for anything. Okay.
Yeah, well, I think they're going in priority of size also. So, their biggest fish will be Chinook, those five-year-old Chinook. Then chum can get to a pretty good size as well, and also coho. So, so at this time of year, they're probably trading off, but the chum would probably be, there may be some stragglers into the local streams right now, but the chum are probably pretty much all in by January. So it would likely be immature rearing Chinook and Coho that they're feeding on right now.
Let's talk a little bit about Mom. Mom is a 31-year-old orca known as L77. She had a first calf born in 2010, did not survive.
Right.
Now, normally, I thought that we normally didn't affix letters and numbers to these animals until we knew they'd been alive for at least 6 months. What is the story there?
Yeah, so that's... I was surprised to see that as well. But I guess, you know, she's been identified. They know she's had her, so they've given her a number.
Okay.
And but you're right. Usually they don't go through that naming process until they've been alive 6 months because mortality is so high in the first 6 months, especially with a new mom. But like you said, she's had, this is her third calf now with her first one not surviving. So hopefully... That her reduced survival won't be because her mother is inexperienced.
Now, in terms of the survival rate for the calves, I'm reading here that the average survival rate at the moment is about 50%. Well, it's been zero for 3 years, but if we stretch back further than that, the average survival rate is about 50%. Is that nutrition, or what is that that's causing that?
I think that it's higher with inexperienced mothers.
Okay.
And then why generally it's so low? That's a good question, Adam. I'm not really sure.
Wanted to ask about the gender of this particular whale as well. You need mummies and daddies for any species to propagate itself. And my understanding is that these new calves, for whatever reason, there's an imbalance of males to females of about 2-to-1 at the moment. And I know there's various theories about what might be causing that.
We actually went back to sort of look over time at that
mm-hmm.
ratio. I guess the one speculation is the role that contaminants might play in skewing that sex ratio.
Yeah, I was wondering if it was something in terms of anatomical differences between the genders, why males might be more likely to survive emaciation or low food than females would.
I'm not sure. The males are assisted. The interesting thing with the males is that their survival is also linked to the presence of their mother, even when they are really mature males.
Yeah.
And if their mothers die, which is the concern right now for K25, because
yeah.
his mother died last year, and he's been seen in ailing health. And so the presence of those mothers really aids, because they're providing food. They're assisting
yeah.
them with food. That's where the concern for the survival of males, anyways.
Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Missy McDuffie, Wild Salmon Program Director, Raincoast Conservation Foundation. I didn't think they normally gave letters and numbers to whales, the new killer whales, until they'd been alive for 6 months because it's, well, touch and go, for lack of a better term. L124, though, that's what media reports are calling this new whale that was spotted for the first time on Thursday. Remarkable. Television stations in Seattle, live footage. Hey, look at the nice whales. Let's get some B-roll is what the broadcasters will call it behind the scenes. Just something to give something moving for your eye to look at. Some nice pictures. And a bunch of sharp-eyed observers noticed that there was a new whale there that shouldn't be there. Yeah, we knew that there was a pregnant whale called a L77. But she has now given birth. Her calf has a letter. It has a number. We don't know the gender yet. In fact, we know very little at this point other than... apparently, it looks healthy. Quick break. Conversation continues after this.
This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
There's a new whale, and we're pretty sure it's still alive. L120, I'm sorry, but gallows humor is sometimes the only way that you can survive the bleakness that has been taking a look at the southern resident killer whale population. L77 is the name of the mother. It's 31 years old. This is her third calf, and that matters because little babies don't come with an instruction manual. As humans have figured out the hard way, child number three usually avoids many of the pitfalls that were faced by child number one because, you know, sometimes parents just don't know any better. Problem is food, though. The whales need enough food to survive. Misty McDuffie is the Wild Salmon Program Director at Raincoast Conservation Foundation. Of course, those wild salmon are the food source for these orca whales. Now, in terms of the food source itself, we talked briefly about the runs of salmon right now because of the time of the year and how chum salmon generally are the whales' preferred food choice. At what point would we expect the Chinook to become more available in terms of the seasonal cycle?
Well, historically, that would have been as early as March.
Okay.
And that's the problem, because those fish would have been returning to the freezer. And this is the issue with the collapse of the run timing, the early spring and or the spring and early summer run timing into the Fraser. And most of those fish in any forms of abundance now aren't showing up before June, even July. And this is why we're so, you know, everyone is so concerned about how many early time Chinook are making it back to the Fraser River, and why several years ago, you know, Raincoast and some of the other groups started calling for closures on the fishing of those early run timing. And so now that's we're seeing whales, which would normally be coming back, you know, into the Salish Sea by, you know, April, are not showing up here until the later runs are coming in, the summer Thompson, summer says Thompson run. So and that's been correlated with the collapse in the early run timing of Fraser Chinook.
I'm wondering if the whales themselves have adapted to these changes, and if we see them sort of anticipating the different run times, or if they find themselves going back to the same places where it used to be, though there was a lot of salmon there, say March or whenever, whereas now they're just absent.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question, and it's actually something researchers have looked at is, it's how do they know where to go? And this is where you see in years of low salmon abundance, the oldest matriarchs in the pods leading the pod because of their learned knowledge, their learned and passed down knowledge of spawning, you know, where Chinook are going, those migration routes, where to look for food, and the other the real disappearance in the spring of say J pod is also correlated with the loss of, remember, Granny J2.
Yeah.
And so Granny for 100 years, or you know, maybe that many, was part of a family unit that would have said, you know, learn to go to the Fraser in the spring, you know, also check out the Columbia sort of, you know, later in the spring, and so would have learned where to go look for salmon. And so both with the collapse of the run and the loss of Granny, J-Pod seems to be spending more time out along the shelf looking for migrating Chinook that are heading south, primarily to the Columbia.
For the benefit of our audience, we've discussed in the past a number of times how these particular animals are matriarchal. They have a queen, so to speak, or the boss is the mom or the grandma, and the family unit sort of underneath her, as well as various other tangentially associated males. The males are very seldom off by themselves. They usually need a female to show them where to hunt, tell them what to do. In terms of these three pods, do they learn from each other? Do they hang out? Do they separate? Because you mentioned how Jay will go somewhere else and maybe K and L won't.
Yeah, so when they come inside, you do see sort of a distinction between sort of pod units, because sometimes some whales from other pods will feed with other pod members. So they're not strictly always within J, K, and L.
Okay.
And sometimes they'll come in with parts of those pods. Sometimes they'll all, you know, form a super pod and they're all together. But when you look at their feeding patterns within the Salish Sea, you do see J pod tending to come sometimes more north. K and L off, you know, will also focus along the bottom of the San Juans. All of them will, or sorry, the bottom of Vancouver Island through the Juan de Fuca. All of them will feed along the west side of the San Juans and then through Boundary Pass towards the Gulf Islands and the approach of the Fraser. But there is these sort of hot spots that different pods or different pod units have throughout the Salish Sea.
One thing I've always wondered is how deep are the salmon when they're out swimming through these areas? Like, how do they stay near the surface? Do they go down really deep? Does it change? How does that work?
Yeah, and this is what, you know, fishermen know really well. So, and there's some work that's being done right now on sort of looking at where they are in the water column, but they can be down, you know, 30 meters, something like that. So they're down there, yeah.
So, but they won't go down like, you know, 500, 600, 700 feet or anything like that.
Again, that's a good question for a fisherman. That does sound a bit deep.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well, I'm just because the reason that I'm curious is that I know that ship noise is a huge concern, and because you've got the Port of Vancouver between the San Juan Islands and us, and every ship that comes in and out of the Pacific has to go through that very narrow area, and you've got all the sound reverberating off the rocks and whatnot there, and the salmon seem to hang out there. I'm just trying to figure out why.
Well, because they're being funneled, you know, geographically through the same region. So,
I see.
And there's Yeah, there's, you know, there's cliffs along there. There's places for salmon to hide if they've got predators chasing them. Yeah, but it's physically they're being funneled through the same general places on, you know, on their way to the freezer.
Okay. Let's take a call, 250-386-1161, star 1070. Let's go to our phone lines where Veronica joins us. Veronica, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I love the documentaries, and in the news, Oregon was talking about their steelhead salmon, mm-hmm. how their humpback, you know, those sea lions, they have a brown kind of hump for their head.
Yes.
They're kind of predators, and they're relocating those seals because they're feeding so aggressively off of the steelhead salmon. So they relocate the seals, but then they make their way back to where they're from. So it's a challenge in Oregon that they're trying to save that salmon and relocate them. I don't know if they bring them up to Canada or what, because they're the vocal ones. They're the loud, and they're kind of predators. So they attack our little harbor seals there that are...
Well, you'd think they'd be able to find their way back if they just moved them up here. Yeah, they just swim back around.
They find their way back, so they keep relocating them. It's like people working to do that all the time.
That sounds
I just
like
to
a...
share that with you because I was on the TV.
That sounds like a rather Sisyphean task, I guess. It would feel like relocating a sea lion that keeps showing up over and over again. Misty McDuffie, sea lions and seals, how do they play into all this?
Yeah, so that particular situation is where the sea lions, and those are California sea lions, and they have, you know, they're located at these falls where was this endangered run of steelhead is trying to make their way through. And your caller's exactly right. They relocate them, and then they swim back. So they have identified individual sea lions that they, you know, well, I'm sure.
I wonder what the sea lion thinks. Like, I wonder what goes through its brain. Oh, I'm being captured again. That's all right. I'm just going to swim back. They can't stop me.
Yeah, well, they're not dumb. So they just make their way back to where they knew they were feeding really well, and it was easy, which is, you know, they've got a great location. The steelhead have to hold, all the salmon have to hold, and it's the same problem in, you know, the locks in certain places where the predators absolutely have an advantage because of the conditions that we've created by modifying habitat. And so they've, you know, in those cases, they've actually started shooting those individual sea lions that are causing the problem on steelhead.
Yeah, and I know that used to be the way it was, is they had a general bounty for seals and sea lions. You could bring in the snouts and whatnot and give them to a government representative, and they'd actually pay fishermen for them once upon a time. It seems like a long time ago, though, Misty.
Yeah, so that was what was happening up until the 1970s when the Marine Mammal Protection Act came in, and you'll hear a lot of dialogue, especially, you know, coming from the fishing community, about the increase in the numbers of seals and sea lions within the Salish Sea, and they're saying, well, do we need to remove these animals? Do we need to kill them and cull them? The studies that, you know, have been sort of looking into this so far, that populations really stabilized over the last 10, 15 years or so. So they're not growing as they were before. They're not recovering. They've stabilized. And it's quite possible that these seals and sea lions eat the predators of salmon more than they eat the salmon themselves. So we could totally destabilize this food web if we start removing pinnipeds, thinking that we're going to improve the abundance and survival of salmon.
So, now, what would that be? What would the predator of the salmon that the seal eats be?
Oh, they'd be cods, tom cods, ling cods, other kinds of, you know, those kind of, yeah.
Because I was thinking, because I've heard the seals and sea lions eat the salmon as well, and they seem to be rather prolific at the moment. They're not dwindling out like the whales are, so I have to wonder what the difference is. I guess the pinnipeds, the seals and sea lions, can eat other fish in addition to just the salmon.
Yeah, absolutely. So if salmon's less than 5% of their diet, they're eating other cod, they're eating herring, they're eating, you know, some forage fish. But I think that, you know, where there is some legitimate concerns is where humans have modified habitat and enabled seals and sea lions to haul out and spend time in places where they previously couldn't because there wasn't the infrastructure for them to pull out on land and be safe from predators.
Okay.
But now, like in the Cowichan, there's definitely a recognized problem that the seals get onto the log booms.
Yeah, I've
and then
seen
they
that.
Just wait until the out-migrating fry come out of the Cowichan, and they just, you know, slither off their log booms and they've got meals. And, you know, and we observe some of the same thing happening at the mouth of the South Arm and the Fraser. And I think historically, you know, seals wouldn't have been able to haul out on those intertidal islands the way they do now because there would have been predators.
Yeah.
It never would have been safe for them. And they need to be able to rest out of the water. So, and now they can.
Interesting. Misty McDuffie, always a welcome guest on the program here. L124 is the designation that would normally be given to this new orca whale once it was alive at least 6 months. Not sure exactly when it was born. It was first spotted on Thursday, though, TV stations in Seattle having some live footage in terms of their newscasts, and some sharp-eyed viewers noticed there was an extra whale that normally wouldn't have been there. They'd known, or when I say they, I mean researchers had known that the mother L77 had been pregnant for quite some time. It seems that the calf is still alive. We all await, though, holding our breath, because if the calf is going to die of starvation or a similar affliction, it'll probably happen relatively soon, as there's about a 50% survival rate. Any final thoughts, Misty McDuffie?
Yeah, so the key right now is that we have to increase abundance and reduce noise and disturbance. And so now these working groups have been established by the federal government, which I applaud them for, and they are they're tasked with coming up with recommendations by April that will improve the abundance down here in the Salish Sea and reduce that noise and disturbance. And I always go back to the fastest way to increase that salmon abundance is to close those fisheries that are on coming down the coast from Alaska, and to reduce noise and disturbance by closing whale watching on southern resident killer whales, and we have to close fin fishing through their priority feeding areas of the Juan de Fuca through the Gulf Islands and to the approach on the Fraser.
Those reports expected in April. Hopefully, L124 is still with us at that point. Misty McDuffie, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, Adam. Always good to speak with you.
Take care. Until next time, that's Misty McDuffie. All right, quick break. The news is next.